because we're, you know, they're debating the calendar here for Parliament. And at this stage, we're not sure. I think those of you who are with us might know about when we're going to be sitting for the year and when not, and so on. But that will be sorted out in the next, hopefully, 2 weeks or so. The second point is that we sent out to you in late December to your constituency offices a program which presupposed that we will deal with the Child Justice Bill immediately and then we will deal with the Regional Courts Bill. But having looked at both bills, I think there's reasonably consensual about this. The Child Justice Bill is proving to be very challenging, whereas the Regional Courts Bill seems to be easier to manage. So we've decided to switch the program around. So colleagues, our friends, I'm just putting this before you. It is nearly a draft. We will come back to vote on it in a week or two. But for now, this is the program. Any questions about the program as we have it here? Again, yeah, I'm guided by you who know more, but my understanding was that the DSO report falls within the NPA report. But can you check that out? But the SIEO is amazed to see it presents its own report. So that's why we put it in separate reports. But when they make their submission, they have suggested that we take both reports together. They didn't say that the DSO also has been included in separate reports, but we will be dealing with DSO matters. Lolly, can you check this out? Whether there's a separate report. But on my table, I don't have a separate report for the DSO. Can anybody remember? Jan, do we do a separate report? JP, I don't know.
The same act, the National Processing Authority Act, yeah. I don't think there's merit in it. The reason why this is separate, the Special Litigation Unit, is a separate act.
Oh,
when that unit was established. So
but the DSO falls within the NPA.
That's what.
So there's no separate report. Okay, that answers your question. Anything else people want to ask about the current talk? Okay, and the second thing is we have got two outstanding reports that have not been adopted. Some members did make contributions. I want to thank you during December. I really feel that I've got more cooperation questions than I anticipated. Most of them were just straightforward and said, look, and I think of all the changes except for colloquial ones. I don't need to debate this now, but even the Parliament's powers will see. Except that it's fine. The committee can say we instead of the committee's of the view. It's more activistic. The committee is an abstract thing. We means human beings. I know Carol doesn't agree with me. Where's Christine? Is she around? Okay, Christine doesn't. Well, it's fine, but nobody's going to die. Then I use colloquialisms like of course and so on. Another member raised that problem. That's a colloquialism. If you all feel so strongly about it, I'll drop it. But of course it's a very specific meaning. In the context that it was used, very specific. It implies that we already know, and it's linked to the previous sentence. So it'd be much longer if you stop, of course. So I think those things people can go to sleep with and not have nightmares about. But if you really want to fight about it, I'm available during lunchtime today. Let's engage about it so we don't have those discussions. Okay? I really think the report must be user-friendly. There must be activistic in orientation. That's what they're really about. But for the substance, I must say, I don't think there's any issues of controversy. So if people like, the reports are coming to you now, I think all five bound, you know?
Yes.
Oh, they're all five bound together. Mm-hmm. And I want to draw your attention to this, that on the 18th of March, which was here, the department will have to reply to all the issues we raised under views and recommendations. Like, for example, let me give you one example, right? If our report has said, as it has, that the legal guide of the Legal Aid Board has not been adopted by this committee, by this parliament since 2002, we would like to know from the department why. They have to give us a reply. They have to say, we haven't been able to do it for 2002 for these reasons. So all the issues, Christina's got an overview of all the issues that emerged, but I think she's been very kind to the department. There are many issues I don't know why she left out, so I'm working through that now, and I will give it to the committee in a week or two and send it to the department. It's not an examination of a trial, it's about delivery. So they've got enough time, maybe 3 weeks ahead, to prepare for the 18th of March. So we are very clear, we're not writing reports for report's sake. We must have delivery. Okay, any questions then about the... obviously, Mayor, you probably gathered from the press. If you haven't, then it doesn't matter. But it seems at this stage, it seems at this stage, that actually it's the Safety and Security Committee that will take major responsibility for the DSO bill. We will have lesser responsibility. That's my understanding at this stage. So what we are seeking to do is to work jointly with them. So public hearings and so on be held together. Now, obviously, that's not something we can decide. The President said end of March, let's hope it's done. And then we'll have to confer with the Safety and Security Committee about when we meet. So I'll just put those dates tentatively. Then the other thing to draw your attention to is Tuesday, 26th of February, review of criminal justice system. I don't know if the ministry will be ready to do that then. But there too, the question mark is because we're going to bring the clusters together. That means correctional services, etc., etc. So that's why the question mark. So for now, is this acceptable? We'll put it for a vote in 2 weeks' time or so, right? Yes, Les?
Chair, just a small thing. We're still awaiting the Director General's performance contract, which is waiting for that for quite
some time. Oh, yeah, sorry. Can we just, he agreed. By the way, OEC wrote to me, I must say that there are some letters that I don't know if you've got. He wrote to explain his absence at that meeting and that the Johannesburg Court and the Johannesburg Attorneys Association and the department met. They met within the time limit. He suggested improved things to them. Just one quick thing, Lolly. The letter from the DG in respect of, when we looked at the annual report, we said to them, go to Johannesburg. Did you send that out to members? The one that simply says we did meet and this is what happened, and in fact, the files that we've seen in those photographs on page one of the Star were actually from a different part of the court and so on. They've not sent that out. Yeah, I think it was sent out to members, but okay, we sent it out to them. He has also responded to all our reports in one sort of like letter, but it doesn't deal with the issues. So we will give you copies of all of that. Yes, but can we please note, Lolly, that we have to write to the DG and ask him for a copy of these. He said, of course, you can have it, and nothing's happened since. So, Lolly, can you just pursue that, please? Can we have it by next week, Wednesday? Copy of his annual performance. Okay. And then Lolly sent the document. This is a public document. Trevor Manuel insists that we must do that. It's part of the PSMA oversight process. There's no issue here. He said, fine. In fact, he didn't. I know. Can we get that done? Okay, anything else? No. Okay. Now, for today, we are going to deal with the... when the reports come, we'll formally adopt the two that we haven't. But for now, we're going to deal, firstly, with the mandating procedures of provinces both. Now, I have alerted members to this. It worked very well in the Provincial and Local Government Committee. And let's see how it works in justice. In public enterprises, it worked very well on the InfraCobo. I don't think the chairperson sitting here should chair all the time. At least it's routine. I mean, I'm ultimately responsible for this committee, and I can be seated here, but we should have co-chairs. The idea being that you rotate and give other people a chance to chair, and, you know, it's boring for you, and so on. And so, depending on the personal chemistry between the chair and the co-chair, we find our way of managing the bill. So, I just need to alert you. The mandating procedures of provinces, though, Carol will deal with, and she will deal with it almost solely. So I'll be here, but she'll run with the bill. Secondly, on the regional jurisdictional regional court amendment bill, JBC Bagnoni and I will be working on this bill together. Though he's got to be away for a little while, and he's been away last week. So as far as that bill goes, can we just agree, your JB, we'll call it opposite of JB, as you know. Right. So your JB has sent us, I've everybody got this, a response to last week's exchanges. Basically what we did was we asked the ARMSA, Aramsa, and the department to meet and sort out their differences. And then see if they can arrive at a consensual thing. Now they did meet, I'm pleased to say, and I thank them. They did work at it and they've done a very nice report. Regrettably, it was only sent last night and I had no access to email and I rolled in at 5 to 10, so I haven't read it, nor have members. But that's fine. You've done the job, that's what matters. Thank you very much. He will first take us through this report. Then what we're going to do is we're going to then get a clause by clause briefing on the bill. Not the overview you gave us, Katie. And then we'll start proceeding with the bill. Now, did we ask for a document that sets out all the amendments to the thing? Is that available? All the amendments to each clause. Is that available? Oh, I see. Towards the... is how you got it. Is this the one? The one that deals with... you see, the one deals with meeting with other stakeholders on 12 February. You've got stakeholder input on substantive issue and so on, right? Where's the part which deals with all the amendments proposed by the submissions we received, you know, like clause 1A, B, and so on? Is that another document that's not yet ready? Okay, so we'll get that document, right? Okay, we'll make copies of it if it hasn't been done. And then we'll go clause by clause. The final thing then, before I hand over to Carol, is I have indicated to the powers that be when I was deployed to this committee that at least one Friday every month I've got party political duties. Sometimes it's two Fridays every month. So I'm not available this week Friday and next week Friday. It doesn't mean the committee cannot continue. But there may be other reasons why the committee doesn't want to meet, which is maybe you feel that... you know, you've just come into Parliament and you want to slide in a bit more easily, or you want to go for a meeting on Friday. So I'm open to whatever you say, but in our program, we have got a meeting on Friday the 15th on this very bill. So do you want to meet on Friday or not? But Friday the 22nd, I won't be here. You have to go ahead with that meeting. You can't have two Fridays. So... what do people, do you want to meet this Friday or not? Sorry? No. Imam? I see. Alright, can we call off this Friday's meeting, Lolly? But then next Friday we have to go ahead. Right, there is another proposal. Bulalani, by the way, is stuck in Johannesburg. He had to go for some party political work and he missed his flight, so he'll be late. John Jeffries told me he's at several meetings where he's worked as parliamentary president. What? President, parliamentary councillor. So neither will be here. Today. Now the question is, next Friday we'll have to meet. So, can we strike a deal? I mean, you've got a management committee, haven't we? Of one member from each of the minority parties, Bulalani, myself, and Comrade Mashlabe from the ANC. We will meet with the other parties and discuss the program more in detail. My own suggestion is that we meet every alternate Friday, rather than every Friday. Just think about it, every alternate Friday. And what we seek to do is where we're under pressure, then we meet in the afternoon, rather. Thursday afternoon. Because, I mean, you know, the other committees don't have the load. That's the only thing that distinguishes us from other committees. We have a higher legislative load. The rest of it, we abide by all the norms that any other committee does. So, in short, can we look into meeting on Thursday afternoon? I will negotiate that with the Chief Whip's office. But, firstly, do you want to think about that, or do you want to give me a mandate to do that now? Right, so now I will, every alternate Friday and then every alternate Thursday afternoon. Except, of course, if we're a three-line whip or Comrade Churchill's Telford is making a state of nation address or something, then we all have to go and get it. But otherwise, every alternate Thursday afternoon and then every Friday alternate. Okay? Right. Carol, over to you. The people are mandating procedures, you here. Where are we? Ah, there you are. We're just getting a briefing today, and then we will go properly with the bill. We've got another floppy.
Good morning. If I can just introduce, it's Mrs. Bowers from the NCOP and Advocate Bandela. Just remember, the mandate and procedures bill is a Section 76(2) bill, which means that it goes to the NCOB first. The NCOB, the select committee, they have made amendments, so what we have before us is the B version of the bill. So over to Mrs. Bowers.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honorable members. Good morning. As this is just a briefing on the bill, I think I will start with just going through the bill, but just as an introduction. The purpose of this bill... the purpose of this bill is to fulfill the provisions of Section 65(2) of the Constitution. And Section 65(2) of the Constitution provides that an Act of Parliament enacted in accordance with the procedures established either by Section 1, Subsection 1 or 2 of Section 76 of the Constitution must provide for a uniform procedure in terms of which provincial legislators confer authority on their delegations to cast votes on their behalf in the NCOB. Now, currently, we do not have such a uniform official procedure that is followed. Currently, each provincial legislature, in terms of item 21.5 of Schedule 6 to the Constitution, determine their own procedure in terms of which authority is conferred on each delegation passport on itself in the NCOB. As I said, as a result, there is no uniformity in the process of conferring mandates by provincial legislatures to the NCOB, and this bill therefore seeks to provide a uniform procedure in terms of which provincial legislatures confer authority on the delegations to cast votes on their behalf in the NCOP. Then, if the committee will allow, we'll then take you clause by clause through the bill. If that is fine.
How do they vote in the NCOP? Do they vote individually or the province of law?
I was actually going to ask that, before we do clause by clause, maybe just explain to us practically, how does it work at the moment? As in, how do they arrive at their mandate, the question that has been asked, and also after the bill, after the legislation is passed, how would the procedure change?
Okay.
But in very practical, concrete terms, so that before we go into the detail.
Okay. Thank you for that question, honourable member. I thought it wouldn't be necessary to provide a background to the procedure of the NCOP, but I think it is useful to do so. What happens in the NCOP currently, voting is obviously taking place per provincial delegation. So the provinces do provide mandates, but they do so in terms of item 21.5 of Schedule 6 of the Constitution. But when we say there is no uniformity, we specifically speaking about the way those provincial legislatures arrive at that mandate. In some provincial legislatures, it is a committee that will sit and get that mandate from the committee and send it through, for example, on a negotiating mandate. But when it's a voting mandate, obviously the House must pass a resolution to that effect. When it comes, so that is basically, and then other, we are the NCO committee in some provincial legislatures. In others, they do have the House that they would fulfill that role in terms of conferring that mandate. So whenever voting takes place, we do receive a piece of paper that is mandate, voting mandate, negotiating mandate, final mandate from a specific provincial legislature. The fact that we're talking about that there's no uniformity is we have had challenges in the regard that we will receive a piece of paper without a letter yet, number one, which to us is obviously not official. Secondly, it wouldn't be signed either by the chairperson of that NCOP committee or the Speaker of the House. Thirdly, there would be no bill number. If the bill number is there, it might be a wrong bill number. It might not reflect the B bill or A bill or whatever. And so those kind of technicalities when it comes to whilst the content may have been arrived at, the committee has deliberated, the House has passed a resolution, but when it comes to then sending or transmitting that information to the NCOP becomes a problem. So in that regard, there is no uniformity. So what we're trying to do is to create uniform procedure in terms of transferring those mandates to the NCOP.
And the process that's being proposed by the bill?
the bill proposes that with regard to that we now define what is the negotiating mandate, what is the final mandate, who arrives at that? Is it the committee? Can they, obviously under the auspices of the House, provide, arrive at the negotiating mandate? Because the select committee specifically felt that we should give leeway to a committee to arrive at the negotiating mandate, but when it comes to a voting mandate, that the House should have resolved that this is the voting mandate, which would then be sent to the leader of the delegation, the head of the delegation, to then obviously cast that vote in the House when the House sits, when the interview sits.
Maybe just at this point, members, any more questions on process clarity before we do close by close? Nothing. Okay.
I would like to say that Advocate Taylor would also be answering some of the questions. Okay, so we're dealing with the mandating procedures of provinces bill. As I already stated, that in terms of the long titles provide for uniform procedure in terms of which provincial legislatures confer authority on the delegations to cast votes on their behalf, as required by our constitutional section 65(2), and to obviously provide for matters incidental thereto. Chapter 1 deals with definitions and applications. It defines obviously your straightforward definitions like the constitution, and then as I said, your final mandate, what is a mandate, NCLP select committee, because we obviously get standing committees in the provinces as well, so we wanted to make that distinction, that so what is a provincial delegation to the NCLP, what constitutes that, and it's obviously in terms of section 61 of the constitution, provincial legislature, that definition there of what is, as I said, negotiating voting mandate, that of difference in definition there. So obviously this act will apply to all provincial legislatures and the National Council of Provinces. Chapter 2 basically deals with the procedure in respect of final mandate and designation of head of delegation. It sets out clause 3 of chapter 3, so clause 3 of chapter 2 sets out that what every final mandate has to contain. So it says that every final mandate required in terms of this act must be on the letterhead of the provincial legislature. Obviously, that was one of the discrepancies that we had. It must indicate the name and number of the bill being voted on, whether the provincial legislature votes in favor, against, or abstains from voting on the bill, contain the signature of the speaker or person designated by the speaker, the address to the chairperson of the NCLP or person designated by the chairperson, and follow the format prescribed in Schedule 2 to the bill. So Schedule 2 has a little block which sets out how the mandate would then preferably look like when it gets sent after the bill is passed, becomes an act to the NCLP. Then if I can continue, if I'm not too far. Sorry. Schedule 2, because Schedule 2 speaks to format for a final mandate. It's the format for the negotiating mandate. The reason why we stated, or the select committee felt that its negotiating mandate should be, the form should be first and then the other one, is because they deal with the negotiating mandate, obviously first before they deal with the final mandate. Although, I don't know if there would be any problem within, you know, changing that numbering.
Could I just ask you, so you have three types of mandates. You have voting, negotiating, and final.
Yes.
Okay. Why are there only two schedules?
Oh, okay.
I'm blonde, you must remember.
The importance with negotiating and final mandates, there's a specific, obvious significance to that. A negotiating mandate is a process where the committee has met, they receive a briefing on a bill. They then come to the point where they've deliberated, blah, 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 and then they come to the point where they must vote on the bill. Then the provincial delegation would send a delegate, or even our permanent members will go brief, and then they'll send someone over, come themselves and brief the committee on what the provisional position of the provincial legislature. So that is your negotiating mandate. They're so open to, obviously, negotiations, to say that this is what is provisionally feel. So how that mandate is conferred is important, because it's your initial vote, and then it might change, but then you obviously need an official procedure for that. Now, in terms of your final mandate, your final mandate is the meeting that would follow after that, just before the voting mandate. The voting mandate takes place in the House. So the final mandate would actually put your final position on the vote, and therefore we also need documentation to the effect that the proof of the isn't as said that this is how they're going to vote on this vote. But then, if Eastern Cape then, in the before the plenary, if the plenary is the next day, and they decide they get another mandate, it's not something that they can negotiate. So your final mandate would probably become your voting mandate in all instances. So it's no longer open to anything. But those the two forms that are attached were seen to be of significance. The committee found that they didn't wanna cluster the vote. They wanted some other things to be governed by the rules of each house, each provincial legislature as well. I don't know if Advocate Sinjela would like to add.
Exercise in the House. Oh, okay, thank you.
Members, any questions so far? Norma Shlawi and then Mr. Hubert. Mrs. Bowers?
If I understand the question correctly, if I may rephrase it, the question appears to be, is it possible that all the provinces can say yes, or all the provinces can say no? Yes, it is possible that all the provinces can say yes to the bill or say no to the bill. Well, those are the positions emanating from the provinces themselves. The province, for instance, if the one province can say, in its own mandate, we voting against the bill. The other province can say we voting in favor of the bill. So it depends on the position adopted by a particular province.
Maybe to add that when such a bill comes before the House in the voting, when the voting mandate, we would obviously look at the constitution and in terms which says that Section 65 matter and all of that in terms of voting takes place in terms of Section 65 and how many provinces obviously voted in favor or against to determine whether that vote will go through. So in our case, majority votes would be 5 provinces would have to vote in favor of such a vote.
Thank you. It's just the numbering of the schedule. Seeing that we're dealing first with Schedule 2, shouldn't it be numbered Schedule 1? I know you do your mandate first, but because we only deal with Schedule 1 in Section, 6?
If it's 75, so then because of the limited powers the OP has over such a bill, you vote according to individuals, or is it? And then if it's a 76 bill, you vote as a collective province. So on a 75 bill, let's say KZN, and the IFP can vote differently from the ANC, but on a 76 bill, as a minority, they have to accept the majority. That's right. Yeah. Perhaps we should indicate that in terms of Section 76, it is a vote in terms of the provinces and not in terms of individual parties.
Happy. Everybody happy. Mrs. Bowers, yeah, you can continue.
I don't know why I'm asking that question. Because then, this issue about mandate, doesn't it take a slightly different meaning? See, if it's a 75 pub, and you're in, say, the Portfolio Committee on Local Government there, what they call them select committees, then what's the point of having mandates? Because if you're an IFP, or let's say Party A and Party B, and you're a minority party, you're not bound by the committee mandate or the House mandate on a 75, because you can vote according to your party mandate. But in a 76, I can see that the mandates will apply to you even if you're a minority party. Am I being clear? Or I don't know, maybe you can have to clarify. Am I being clear?
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, yeah, I hope that I understood the question correctly. This deal deals with issues requiring or matters requiring mandates, and it does not deal with obviously Section 75 deals. It doesn't apply to Section 75 deals. Yes. Okay. All right.
Can I respond,
my dear
also? So if the chairperson would look at the definition clause, you would see that when it talks to legislative mandate, it refers specifically or it specifically excludes Section 75.
Mrs. Bowers, yeah, you can continue with your clause by clause.
Thank you, Chairperson. So I don't know if I, so Schedule 2 is obviously there to look at for the committee. Then clause 4 deals with requirements in respect of designation as head of delegation, and it basically just confirms what the constitution is saying, who is the head of the delegation when it comes to provinces voting within the NCLP. It says a premier of a province or a delegate of a provincial delegation designated by the premier must cast a vote on behalf of a provincial legislature. Okay. And then if we can continue to chapter 3, it deals with procedures in respect of mandates. Clause 5 specifically, legislative mandates requiring both negotiating and final mandates. And it says specifically legislation that deals with section 74 of the constitution, 1B, 2B, 3B and 8, and then sub 8. And then section 76 of the constitution, which once again confirms the difference that we're not specifically focusing in this bill on section 75. Clause 6 deals with negotiating mandates and the procedure that should be followed by provincial legislatures in arriving at negotiating mandates. And in terms of clause 6, a committee designated by a provincial legislature must confer authority on its provincial delegation to the NCLP of parameters for negotiation when the relevant NCLP select committee considers the bill after tabling and before consideration of final mandates, and may include proposed amendments to the bill. So that is basically a definition of what a negotiating mandate is, and provide some guidance in terms of how they can arrive at that. Clause 7 deals with the final mandate, and it says that a provincial legislature must confer authority on its provincial delegation to the NCLP to cast a vote when the relevant NCLP select committee considers the vote prior to voting thereon in an NCLP plenary. Clause 8 deals with voting mandate, and it's got two subsections. This is a provincial legislature in one must confer authority to vote on the head of the delegation or a delegate designated by the head of the delegation to cast a vote in an NCLP plenary, and sub 2, if no matter arises from the deliberations of the NCLP select committee when considering final mandates which may necessitate consideration by a provincial legislature, the provincial delegation from a provincial legislature to the NCLP must table its province's final mandate in the NCLP plenary as that province's voting mandate. And then chapter 4, basically, clause 9 deals with the short cycle and commencement of the Act when promulgated. Schedule 1 and 2 are your forms or your mandate forms that you would require, and then the memorandum on the objects of the bill is also attached to the bill. Thank you.
Yeah, the obvious question which would arise is, what would be the status of mandates if provinces don't? Let's say they're supposed to hand in the form, either Schedule 1 or Schedule 2, and they don't, and they carry on negotiating. I mean, what would be the status? Do you give? What about things like giving provinces? I mean, can you condone if they don't adhere to? I mean, what happens if they simply don't hand in these schedules?
I can start, and if Advocate Sindela wants to add. When it comes to the provision of mandates to the NCLP, provinces have always been good in providing that, but if such a situation arises, we deal in a 6-week cycle. We used to deal with both in a 4-week cycle, but now it's extended to a 6-week cycle, which gives provinces more time to then have public involvement processes within BOLD. So if a province then would can write to the chairperson of the NCLP to ask for an extension to say that due to whatever reason we have not been able to conduct our public participation processes and we would require additional time, the chairperson then refers such a request to the committee and the committee will deliberate on whether they can give province whatever more time to then, that would obviously hold their processes in terms of voting, either negotiating or final.
Members' questions, Mr. Swart, Mr. Yubar, Imam, in that order?
I'm sure that this issue has arisen, but the whole concept of passing legislation required by the Constitution within a reasonable period, as required by Section 20, Item 21(1). Now, you recall the ACD UDM Constitutional Court case relating to straw custody, that at that stage found that the legislation was not passed within a reasonable time. How are you going to meet that challenge? If someone challenges this legislation? Because clearly a period of 12 years has passed. And can that, by any stretch of the imagination, be seen to be within a reasonable period?
Yes, that's a very difficult question for us administrators. I'm not sure if you can respond to that question. We may not be in a position to respond to that question at present.
But I do think you need to consider it because, as you know, many of the decisions of the NCLP have been challenged for various reasons, and this could lay yourself open again. If we pass this legislation in its present format, all decisions of the NCLP could then be challenged by any party that is unhappy with that. So maybe you can think about it as a difficult question. Thank you.
If you firstly you're representing the NCLP here, can you come back to our answer to that question? In fairness to the committee, you know, I understand it's not fair on you to answer now, but when we meet next time, I think there must be an answer. You can't say, I can't answer the question, then bring somebody who can. You know, the point relates to that is, excuse me, why is it taking so long to bring this up? To me, I do pages.
Chairperson, I just want to say that the process had started in 2004. A draft was ready in 2004. This bill is different in the fact that it was a bill that had gone through three phases. Obviously, at that time, the then chairperson of the NCLP looked at the issue of legislation that had to be passed in terms of the Constitution and said that this bill is long overdue. And she then requested the administration to facilitate the introduction of or to come up with a draft. And then what happened was a technical task team was constituted. Obviously, in this process, it's a long process because we're working with the provincial legislatures. But then the first phase was to then get legal advisors and procedural staff from the various provincial legislatures and parliaments, the National Assembly and the NCLB, together in a venue to come up with a draft. That draft was obviously presented the next year in May, 2005 only, to the political office bearers at a workshop where speakers from provincial legislatures were also present. They then looked at the bill and they made some amendments. So there were a lot of issues, for example, the issue regarding international agreements and other issues that they found that the bill should also address, but there were different views on that. So it was a prolonged political process. That actually we cannot then say, give reasons as to, other reasons as to why the bill was not being proceeded with.
Look, it's no reflection on the two of you. And you're so young. I don't think you were even here when the SCOP was formed, right? But I must say, you know, if I played back a tape recording to you what you said a week from now, you'll see that at the end of the day, it's really no excuse, honestly. I mean, even bring the first draft in 2004, that's 8 good years beyond the NCOP being launched. I mean, a basic thing like this, it's really bad. It reflects badly on Parliament. And we can't, you know, as a committee, just overlook it. This has to stop. These are easy things to do, relatively speaking. So look, my own view, I don't know when I carry the majority with me, but I mean, the majority must convince me that I'm wrong. The other way around. It's really not acceptable. And we must stop this thing. These are things we can do, and we should do. But it's no reflection on the two of you, let me say. As I said, you know, it isn't. Thank you.
About it a little bit as well. I think what he's saying is, what is the NCOP doing to ensure that bills move, that they don't end up in file 13 and gather dust? Now, yes, it's important to strike that balance between leaving enough time for meaningful public participation and involvement, but you also can't let it lie and gather dust for years and years and years. So when you come back to it, just sort of tell us how the NCOP does that. How does it strike that balance? And then also what Mr. Grimm and Mr. Swart asked as well. And yeah, Mr. Swart, yes, of course.
Yeah, I think it's a very serious problem legally. Besides the bills in general, this is a specific clause requiring legislation in terms of the Constitution to be passed within a reasonable period. And as I indicated, the Constitutional Court has already said that that legislation that was passed in 2002 was not passed within a reasonable period. The only answer, and subject to coming back with something else, is a constitutional amendment. That is the only way that floor crossing legislation was then passed, was that the constitution was then amended. So it's not legislation passed in terms of the constitution. It required a constitutional amendment. I might be wrong, I'm just thinking off the top of my head. I'm sure that once you've considered this and spoke to the relevant people, you can come back. But off the top of my head, I don't know how you can meet the argument that this legislation, this particular piece. The second argument about other legislation is important, but this piece of legislation that was required to be passed in terms of the Constitution within a reasonable period, I think that there's a very serious problem with that. Thank you.
Before I allow Mr. Huber, if I could, yeah, Mr. from the department, Mr. Labuschagne, if I could maybe just tap your brain on this issue.
Chairperson, thank you. I don't want to interfere, but maybe I can assist you. Or just in answering Mr. Swart's question, if you look at section 65.2, no reference is made within reasonable time. It only says that provides that an act of Parliament must provide for a uniform procedure. And then if you go to Schedule 6, item 20.1.5, it only says that until the Act of Parliament referred to in section 65.2 has been enacted. So I don't think the argument that was raised in the UDM case will apply in respect of this bill. Although I do agree that it did take a long time to get this far, but I don't think that your argument, or the argument of the court, that within reasonable time will be applicable in this case. Thank you, Stephen.
Sorry, I don't want to engage, but would you explain 21.1 for me how that does not apply? It's like in 21.1. Hopefully your argument is correct, because I think we all want, you know, we want the legislation passed, but we don't want to pass legislation that has a constitutional challenge. How would you explain 21.1, where it speaks about the enactment of national legislation? That legislation must be enacted within a reasonable time. How would one distinguish that between 21.5?
That might be a good argument, but in the UDM case, that specific item that provided for floor crossing, that specific item 23, capital A of the interim constitution, that item provided within reasonable time. So maybe in this case, after reconsidering the matter, your arguments could be applicable. But I think let's see people of the NCC come back on the matter, but on the side of it appears to me that we might get away with this issue.
Okay, just, I'm going to, yeah, on the same issue. Okay, thanks.
If I may be allowed to also lay a small egg. I think what, because I was involved in the floor crossing legislation, as you will recall, I think the main distinction there was that the constitution provision was that there will not be floor crossing. Then there was an exception. So Parliament may reconsider, and within a reasonable time, they may change that without even changing the constitution. And I think that's where we failed the test when it reached the constitutional court. It said no, that was a special mechanism in terms of which you could have changed the constitutional provision without following the ordinary processes for amending the constitution. And because of that time lapse, the constitutional court said no. You can still do it, but now if you want to do it, amend the constitution, you cannot do it through other legislation. That of course will not change the fact that if it's not a reasonable time, that event is. I don't think there will be any legal consequences apart from the negative perception arising from it.
Thanks. So, Mrs. Bowers and Advocate Pandela, you've heard all the various arguments. I think take some time to, you know, and come back to us on that point. I mean, and just give us a response to that.
There's no need to have a long discussion. But I thought you were saying that somebody, hopefully, it would be so unnecessary to do this, and what do we manage in this? But somebody might say, because, if this is what Steve is saying, somebody might say, because this is only being passed now, what we've been doing in the NCOP since 1996 is ultra vires or something. Let's give a sense. Now, if that's the case, can you put in a provision here that sort of, like sort of covers that? Retrospectively is the word Carol's using, that, you know, that we take it that all legislation has been passed. Yeah.
I think that they covered by 21.5. Everything that's done up to now is fine. But as soon as you pass this legislation and start mandating in terms of that, then one could say that that legislation was not passed within a reasonable time. Even if you set aside the UDM ACDC court case, which was a specific period, and say 12 years is not a reasonable time. And I think that could be the main challenge that we need to consider. And I think there's compelling argument to say that to pass this legislation 12 years later is not within a reasonable time. And then, from now on, to contest any decision that is taken in terms of that matter. So I think we need to consider that very carefully.
All right, let's see, it's there and then Imam.
Just a small point, Chair. We say in Section 3E that the format prescribed should be followed, and that concerns Schedule 2, but we don't say anywhere that Schedule 1 format should be followed. Don't you think we should add it in Section 6 at the end?
Valid point, I think. Mrs. Bowers, Advocate Pandela?
Yes, we accept that, Chair. It should have been reflected under Clause 6.
Imam?
Thank you, Chair. If as far as delegated mandates are concerned, particularly from the Premier to a member of the NCOP to vote on behalf of the head Premier, I see there is no specification here that it should be. Right? In the case of controversy, how do we handle this?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the question, Imam. What happened here is that the committee felt that some things should not be set out in legislation, and that the rules of provincial legislatures will govern those particular instances. For example, that to state that the Premier must in writing send in like a form or something like that. So that has been discussed as well by the select committee, but they felt that the restatement of the constitutional section is fine, and then the procedure in terms of which we should be governed by the rules of each provincial legislature and how they will arrive at that.
Thanks. And then just a final point. I seem to recall that the Department of Justice drafted proposed amendments and made certain inputs. Now, could I ask Mr. Labuschagne just what that position is? And also if Mr. Labuschagne, maybe if the committee would give Mr. Labuschagne a mandate to maybe just sit down with Mrs. Bowers and Advocate Mandela and then come back to this committee to tell us what the comments and proposed amendments were that were suggested by Justice and which of those amendments were accepted and which were not accepted. And if not accepted, why not? What the thinking behind it was, just so that we can get a bit of background.
Thank you, Jackson. Yes, my department did submit comments to the Chairperson of the Select Committee, but that was purely from the angle that my department firstly administers the Constitution, and secondly that this bill seeks to give effect to the requirements of Section 65(2). But we did, I think it was in July 2007, submit the comments to the Chairperson of the Select Committee.
Okay, so will you be in a position to then, after deliberation, just come back to us and take us through those amendments and subsequently what which were accepted and which weren't? Thank you. Members, anything else? Happy? Okay.
Before we go on to the regional court, so then, thanks, Carol. The date you come back is the next, after we deal with the two reports, then we've got, Wednesday, the 27th of February. We're dealing with the jurisdiction of regional court, so we'll first deal with the mandating of procedures, so, and hopefully finish it and then vote on it the next morning, on Tuesday, the Tuesday. So, Wednesday the 27th, you're back here. Tuesday the 4th, we vote on the bill. Okay? All right. Thank you very much. Thanks, Karen. Now, on the two reports you have before you, as I suggested in the email that I sent you, it's really from the committee's response section that you would want to comment, because the rest is an overview of what the respective bodies said to us. So let's look at the South African Human Rights Commission report. All of you have sent copies and some of you made comments. All the comments were accepted, actually. There weren't many, there were about three or four of you made comments. We accepted all except for the stylistic one. So it's section 6 on page 8 onwards. There's nothing there that we disagreed on. In fact, some of you made some useful comments and I just added. But can we take it as read? Because this is ongoing work, really. And on the 18th, we will take the department through it and ask for their responses. So, does somebody want me to go through it, or are we agree that it's taken as read? Good. Okay, so is there a mover for the report? Carol, seconder? Imam, okay. So, this report has already been sent to the Ministry and the Human Rights Commission and whoever else is keen to have a copy. It must now go into the ATC. So it'll go to the ATC the next day. We'll just put dated, that's the only thing that is funny, okay? The dated, today's date will go in there. And then the report on the Gender Commission. As I suggested to you, well, it's not a crime. We send this to the stakeholders to comment on. They cannot interfere with the section from committee's response down, which is our view. Before that, they can comment. They can comment if they like on the committee's response. I must tell you, we got very good responses from both organizations. They're really, really keen on the report. They've been using the reports already, I'm told. I know in the case of the Gender Commission, they distributed to everybody. I know the Legal Aid Board, I bumped into somebody at the airport who served on the Legal Aid Board and who wasn't here that day, who read the report. I was very surprised, actually. And the Gender Commission once asked to meet with them for a whole day. I said, well, that's going to be tough. But half a day with the Joint Monitoring Committee and setting a time for that. So they were very keen on the report and they sent it out to all their staff and everybody. So, you know, these reports, they don't collect dust if you activistic in orientation. I really think it's worth doing. But it's really the department and the commission, the security body themselves who must respond now to us. Are they doing these things? Okay, so on the Gender Commission report, can we take it to the table? Okay, right, mover, Mama Flower, seconder, okay, JB, that's done. Okay, JB, can you join me? We're now going to deal with the regional court bill. Now, to be fair to JB, he was not here last week. He will take major responsibility from the next time we sit. So I will, he will take over the next time. Right now, I'll have to manage this process for you because you were not here last week. But just to brief you, we, and just remind the committee, we asked ARMSA in the care update. Oh, he's gone, the guy, that's fine. That's his right. Let's go, JD. You're going to tell us what came out of the negotiations you had, and you've given us what is called OHLC. No, it's... oh, yeah, it's just one here. So you met, and you're going to take us through the issue.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief so that my colleague could start going through my thoughts. At the beginning, I just wanted to report that we are accompanied by a representative of the Reserve Court President here. It's Mr. Ngadala, Reserve Court President from Northern Cape. Ms. Monalady, Reserve Court President from Northwest. Mr. Haini, Reserve Court President from here. And Ms. Yaki Vachas, who is from the Training Committee. And it's not normal that they accompany us to Parliament because the court must run. But we've made a special arrangement that they be here today because this is a huge person then and they should follow up on the issue of this case. And we would like to thank the opportunity we've had to from this committee group and engage the stakeholders. We did that over the last past 2 days. And there are very positive outcomes that came from the deliberation. And I think all members were there, have the sense that this bill is going to revolutionize their court and is going to have huge impact on access also. What we have done is just make a brief report to go through and also will indicate what were the key points that came from each and every stakeholder we met over the last 2 days for the benefit of the honorable members here. If you look at page 1, basically we first met with Aramsa, who had made a formal submission, and they made some huge technical points to the bill. And I think we'll pick up those aspects as we go on cross by cross. But large of them, just from this report, relate to the issues they've raised, whether this bill only extends matters as this, you know, the other matters like the ones which are closely excluded by different pieces of legislation to the original court, etc. PAIGA does not extend to the promotion of access justice. Does not extend jurisdiction immediately. Other suggestions, the Will Act, other relating to the status of mental couples, does not do so. And what we agreed at the meeting is that those are matters that should be basically looked at your policy level because it's a critical process. As and when we move forward with the jurisdiction, there are other people to be involved. When you're dealing with the issues that lead to waste, for example, your masters are the crucial part in the process. The judges are sequencing the process. So we'll have an incremental approach so that as and when we check each and every piece of legislation, we have the views of those people involved that might be. If six wanted to start opening the gates, that several cases should, regional courts should be able to deal with civil cases. 2.3, the aspect raised around the whole issue of infrastructure and collection capacity. What we did yesterday, Chair, the meeting was in twofold. We looked at substantive issues from the bill and we looked at implementation issues or process issues that will impact on substantive issues, etc. And both aspects were covered in detail and the report will show us to move on. So, parallel to this process, there's an ongoing process to increase capacity of the court, flux of the court. A judicial establishment posed for magistrates. There's a team that looks at infrastructure implications, whether the current court will be able to accommodate the increased jurisdiction, whether they need for additional accommodation. All these are taking place in multinational process. We just wanted to mention that not that all the 752 courts are used optimal because of limited jurisdiction. We did say last time that we still have courts, we still have the capacity and the accommodation to accommodate people. But because they themselves, those courts have got limited jurisdiction, they have not been used optimally. So this will provide opportunity to get them to be used optimally, but also to get some other infrastructure required as well. Section 46 is what I've been referring to. It talks about all those aspects that are basically excluded from the jurisdiction of the court. And it's a very old provision. and will be dealt with as part of the policy process moving forward with the bill. Now we have articulated stakeholder by stakeholder key features of race. What I wanted to mention is that we did also try to get all the persons beyond the ones who did not make submissions to Parliament. Not that we have not been engaging them in the past, Chair, because we just wanted to revise what we have been discussing with them, and if there are any developments in terms of the views they have always expressed to us, etc. The Judicial Quality Assurance Office, which are the support structure of the Market Commission in terms of providing support in terms of the quality work of the local judiciary and the post, came there and made presentations and basically indicated that to the extent that the bill requires capacity, we have to make sure that the capacity aspects in terms of post and infrastructure and are being looked at before the implementation takes place, etc. And we are able to announce that they are part of the intersectional committee that will look at the capacity and the plan is being worked currently, which will be reduced capacity aspects. Market Commission was represented by two persons, and one of them is here today, Mr. Ellis, a member of the Commission. Samabas was also there yesterday, and I think they also expressed the very same view that this matter have been on the table for quite some time, and we need to make sure that as we move forward, we are assured that it will not collapse. There's enough infrastructure to care over the vision and the intention that we seek to convey. There was a positive input, which because I said that any training program that should be required in terms of training regional magistrates or any other person to reach in terms of civil justice exposure should basically be in liaison with Justice College, and which is a point that we have taken to and we have to factor in the legislation as we took that, because the commission do have a training committee of which Professor Delport is a chairperson, etc. One aspect which was very critical and which basically was the juncture point of Tuwaza relates to the qualification of magistrate. And I wanted to put it very clear that it's a sore point in the magistracy, and there's been a sore point. How the court are structured now is that today a regional magistrate, the legislation required you to have LLB, and that has been the position since the past 4 decades or so. And the reason was that the reason given obviously is that at the entry level of magistracy, there were different forms of qualifications then. People could enter the magistracy with diploma juris, with B juris, or with any certificate that could have been approved by the minister, as long as themselves are satisfied that basically it provided enough competence to do the matters, etc. So those certificates, so there were different requirements. Now, after the academic sector has done away with the B juris and the diploma juris, the only degree available is LLB to become a lawyer or to become a judge, etc. And from there you can advance to other, etc. Now, there were attempts in the past to consider the suggestion that LLB be scrapped so that you don't prescribe requirement per se, but you adhere to the requirement of proficiency per se as in the Constitution, and those methods are also debated at the committee here. By the time to assert that those methods should not be removed from the legislation because it's about quality. I don't think that one would have expected that any person at the entry level of magistrate who had less than 5 years experience with diploma juris could deal with complicated family matters which are not part of the specialized study at that level of qualification. At the school at the time, we only dealt with family law at an LLB level. We only dealt with advanced criminal law at an LLB level. A diploma juris is dealt with elementary studies. I don't think at that time it would have been appropriate to remove the requirement without making sure that you don't work down the competence of the judiciary also. Now it's so that requirement has become obsolete because no longer we all have one qualification. Now it should obviously move out of the statute book. But that does not mean then that the Market Commission or the JC Commission, it is not in the statute book, will appoint somebody with metric to say judge. Does not mean that. All that is that we don't want to prescribe in the legislation. But those institutions which are there, as they do their assessment of candidates, will take the qualifications, whether it's LLD, LLD, whatever, and any other criteria that they want to put to be able to assess the competence of any person who's been for this appointment. So those are the aspects. And we agree from the perspective that since the requirement is not there for judges, there's no reason it must be there for any other person. But we are not saying that it's not important. There are relevant qualifications. In fact, at the KSC, where honorable member policies, they emphasize the highest level of competence and academic qualifications. And those, we still believe that they are very essential in terms of quality also. The divorce court president were invited. We could not invite them today here because we did indicate that what happens is that the sitting circuit, there are only three. The Southern Divorce Court, Mr. Clarkson, deals with 8,000 cases per annum, each division, which goes across three provinces. So they don't have time in between to deal with any other matter, etc. So they made sacrifices yesterday and made necessary appointments in that division to be with us, so that they could come and air their views with us as we move forward. Because part of the impact of the bill is going to integrate the divorce courts into regional courts. One, we don't have divorce courts or divorce judges. We never had them in the past. We never had judges trials in divorce matters. We had judges of the High Court who were generalists who could deal with any matters, motions, etc. But in the lower court, we created a system where we had divorce judges other than all the aspects. As if divorce was the main concern of South Africa. It is not. We are saying that we should not create a system that families are such in disarray in this country that we must sometimes it's not comforting. We do have the courts must be there so that they should be assisting the people as and when they are not able to reconcile in their marriage, etc. But the magistrates and the criminal officers who are there should be able to assist families across all those family law related matters. Hence we say that if you provide them with competence to deal with issues of custody, issues of guardianship, issues of all these aspects within the three law context that would be acceptable. And one magistrate, whoever is there, should be basically be competent to deal with those aspects, etc., not to specialize in divorce matters. I think that's our crisis point. The viewpoint from the divorce court president, the president of Central Divorce Court, the busiest one, was fully behind the initiative, because she says the current one is very cumbersome. She says she has to receive faxes midnight after midnight from Friday, from Lichtenberg, where she's the only one in Johannesburg, where people want urgent application. No one else in the country can do it. Somebody must fax to stop another member in the membership from disposing of a house. You can't wait for the spreading of such come after 2 months. If papers are already with the estate agents who want to dispose houses and you want to stop that one interdict, the only court that we have can deal with it, either High Court or the Divorce Court. Because of the court challenges, people go to the Divorce Court and there are few people that are in jail because of. So she welcomed the bill. The divorce court president for Lebowakgomo did say that we must make sure that as and when we move forward, we don't lose the nucleus of the family court concept, so that it becomes lost in the regional court, etc. So those were the aspects we raised. I know, and I think I'll be very. It will be required of me also to express that one of the divorce court presidents did suggest that the current status quo be kept as it is. For the Southern Divorce Court, once it was working. There were views from the Legal Aid Board Chair. We did manage to get the Legal Aid Board. They indicated the capacity constraints from that side. And we are saying these are not insurmountable problems. They said that for every justice center, they've got one legal officer who deals with civil matters, etc. And what we need to do need to be dealt with in terms of the verification on that side. And we've always held the view that the Legal Aid Board over a long term should not be the only vehicle for which the state provides legal services. they are busy in terms of finding the family advocate dispensation and function to be able to deal with all matters that relate to vulnerable groups, etc. So as we move forward as the department, must look broadly, not only in terms of one sector, etc. But we say this bill will basically put our heads together, because in terms of supporting the cause that they seek to provide, we'll be able to do that what they've been given. What we have also done, so you remember that there was a question that came from the parliamentary session, 8 of them. We just gave a point in terms of how we responded to them. We did try to provide answers there. And the answers, Chair, are not right answers or wrong answers. And look, we are not coming from the fact that there won't be challenges or we are defensive in approach. All we are saying this process is long overdue. And if it's about climbing Kilimanjaro, let's start climbing it now. Let's not go back and say we can't climb the mountain because we don't have coal. Then we'll never climb the mountain since 1952. All we are saying, he said there will be teething challenges, there will be problems, but we are taking the incremental approach, we are not taking the whole second policy, and we will be able to make sure that the integrated implementation committee that we've established will guide everything in terms of making sure that all things are covered as in this process. And I just wanted to mention in passing that the minister did raise this matter with the head of court, the judges, on the 7th. They were also given the copy of the bill. There were correspondence sent to the chief prior to the 7th, indicating our intention to send a serious notion. So they are praised of the matter. They have not made written submissions, but they have not written to us objections to the bill. And we are saying that to the extent that it would alleviate the High Court, as said earlier on, this bill does not take matters from the District Court. It alleviates at the top and brings down, etc. And we have the view that if there were very substantive objection from the legal point, the judge should have expressed that. What we have there, we had judges who individually and out of the court said, yes, well, as and when you look at the extending of the civil jurisdiction to the regional court, you must also look whether you can take some of the review and appeal to them. Because everyone who has been sentenced for 6 months in a district court cannot appeal to the regional court. Must go to the high court for an appeal and go and argue for leave of appeal. Now, the case of somebody who has been sentenced for life and somebody who has been sentenced for 15 years is fighting for space in their registrar's diary. With somebody who has been sentenced for 500,000 rand, for 100,000 rand, because the Central Court don't have a criminal jurisdiction. They can't deal with matters which they think can offload the High Court. And that point also realized that was also picked up by the Gender Commission. And we say we won't be able to meet right away. But it's also one of the evolving aspects that we have to look at as part of meeting our courts to meet. Lastly, Chair, I just wanted to raise that there have been some in common input from the media. There have been some radio talk show where we received at the SAFM radio listening programs where people wanted to understand the input. We have not got one caller from the ordinary South Africans who say don't go ahead. They said the South African says this is going to help us. It's long overdue. I've got a matter which has been overstanding for four years. I'm still waiting for a date at the High Court in Johannesburg. If this court can come to Soweto, Soweto, the biggest as it is, does not have a civil court. 2.6 million in Soweto cannot litigate in this country. Because in the past, there was belief that they have nothing to litigate about. They never owned the houses because they stayed in 99 houses they alone. Now they own houses. If they want to litigate on those houses, they must go to the High Court instead. Hence, he says, these are the views we got from them. And it will also be unfair of me to basically say, despite the positive input we got, that Chowasa did raise some concerns. And the concerns that they raised were not based on the bill per se, but were based on the impact on the judiciary, likely on the fact that most of the magistrates they have do not have LLD. So if you extend this jurisdiction to the higher level, it means you deny opportunity for career passing for the magistrates who have been in the system for 30 years. to go up, etc., who did not have the opportunity to go to school, etc. I say, okay, it's one thing that the past did not allow everybody quite opportunity to grow in terms of academic qualification. But we do have people who also within that tight environment made advances and acquired experiences. We should not hold the public at ransom because we have not prepared ourselves to meet the challenges. I think what we are saying, let the bill proceed, what we'll do, we'll find means of assisting those people to upgrade their qualifications so that they could get career passing. That's the general overview I wanted to give, Chair, and I think all my colleagues who are here today have been part of those discussions, and I think they could add where I could have left out on the general overview before we go to the bill itself. Thanks, Chair. Yes, we have replied to all questions. Let me go to you from page 7. One of the questions was basically the appointment process and status of presiding officers and of the individual court and regional court magistrates. Professor Delport will bear me out. We sit together at the Masters Commission. We don't entertain applications for Masters for divorce courts. We have never done so at the Commission, simply because they are not yet integrated within the Masters Court dispensation. The Masters Act does not define presiding officers of a divorce court as a magistrate, technically. And therefore, that's why we say the Commission does not have direct jurisdiction, autonomy over the divorce court presiding officer, and that's an anomalous situation. The executive and the minister still appoint, while the master commissions appoint. So we're still running a parallel system, and it goes down the tracks of the court. The register of the divorce court is appointed separately from the register of the high court, and I will say that this will be kindly assist the process. There was a question on the implementation rollout, how we thought we were going to roll out the measure, etc. And what we said is that we have established an integrated multi-sectoral task committee that will look at the implementation aspect, that will look at the HR personnel, where are we going to need magistrates, what's the number, etc. I want to assure the chairperson that this has been on the training process did not start now. It has been there. That's why part of the money we have not used in the judiciary, local judiciary, is simply because we have not yet finalized the jurisdictional areas. We have been carrying over, we have 37 million carried over from last year. I'm sure our school were informed yesterday that in terms of MTS sector, that money grow to more than 60 million next year, etc. But if we have not, if we don't look at, because the basic for the motivation for the increase of the baseline was basically to take into account these aspects of access to justice. Now, if we move slow in terms of the creation of the judicial pool, we stand to lose the money which is already there in terms of treasury allocation. Justice College is on board in terms of the training measures, and we have said that there need to be an interface between the regional court president, Massive Commission, and Justice College to say, look, these are training aspects that need to be looked at urgently, where do we stand, etc. ARAMSA has developed a training program that could basically complement whatever training efforts we have made here. And then from the government, from the department side, we have said that we would have fun to fund that program, and then it needs to be integrated within all the stakeholders. Our director and I have emphasized the need to get the law society, they were here, they supported the training program. So what we are doing now, really, we are organizing a meeting of all the stakeholders affected by the training program so that they should start an integrated training program that should take us forward while Parliament continues deliberation on the day. Monetary resolution, the minister has indicated that we must make it in a way that it provides meaningful access. And we said the reason why we wanted it to be by notice from the government is to allow, is to request parliament to delegate the minister, so the minister can, as an financial and inflationary target, influence the situation, to be able to adjust the monetary aid also. And we thought that we got input that we could start with 500,000 from some of the stakeholders we met, and we thought that should not be a challenge as far as we are concerned. But what we also said, Chair, the monetary aspect will not only look at the result cost. We say we may even have to adjust all the layers of the civil justice to increase success. The fact that the small case cost is 7,000 rand, when to open a file and ask him, you need 7,000 rand, another certain situation. We may want to adjust the small case cost to 10,000-15,000, so that at least those other matters are put here, and then adjust the 100,000 cost level to about 150-200, and then give regional cost an increased amount of about 200 to 800,000, whatever. But there will be consultations on this aspect, and I think we need to be informed by what impact will have on the people. We want immediately take a policy here that will erode the aspirations and intentions that we wanted to achieve in terms of implementing case. We did circulate that with the presentation chairperson of all the courses, and we do have them here. And I think to the extent that it may be necessary at some point to analyze them, we'll be available to do so. And we think that it's going to, the bill will address the case backlog extensively, because by reducing the cycle time within which cases are being finalized, if the case that takes 2 years to finalize them in 6 months, it means in a year you do more cases than currently the structure does. So we do hope that associated or accompanied with the commitment to increase the capacity of the court, we should be able to deal with the case backlog more diligently and more effectively. The question number 7 was, how do people still choose divorce court how do people continue to use divorce court if they are cheaper than the high court? Firstly, we are saying divorce courts are not acceptable in terms of territorial allocation. That's why they still go to the high court, because one would not basically wait for a 2 month cycle to use an agent matter, like the example I've given. If you have to get an interdict agency and you are not able to get to the divorce court presidency, when you sex, the first cannot get through, or the divorce court is on legal, etc., you are not recourse. It's to go to the high court. So people are compelled. I don't think it's by choice. I think we're still, the system at the still drives people to the high court for easy access. And we think that if we address the system in a way that should address that, people will go to the original court system. People are very, I think I've got little options. That's why they still go to the high court. And there was a question here, say, if you create concurrent jurisdiction, are you not creating a overlap and a fragmentation? That's the basis of the argument for this bill. What happened, the concurrent jurisdiction came from the fact that when these divorce courts were initially established, they were still for a particular sector of society. And when they were de-racialized in 1997, they wanted to keep the right of access to the other group which had existed. There was never intended at the time that you must erode the right away from those who had access to the high court in the past. All it did is tell us, keep the current situation, give concurrent jurisdiction, give the people the choice. And that choice is a very expensive choice. You go to a high court because you have the money. Now, if you are very poor, you're staying in the city, you can't go to a high court. So you don't have that choice. So that concurrent jurisdiction doesn't give a choice, basically. It entitles those with able means to still continue to access the high court, etc. So we thought this would also address those kinds of things. There was a question of how to also receive an appointment, and I did raise that with a professor who was nodding his head, that we have never dealt, the commission does not deal with magistrate presiding officers. The act does not, SF drafted, does not allow us to do so. Now, one person may say, why don't you change the act to do that? But I don't think it's ideal to run different systems in one dispensation, instead of providing for magistrate commission to appoint magistrates and other categories of people. rather change the system so that all magistrates, and this is what the X62 to achieve. I wanted to raise one point which was not asked, but was asked pertinently during our consultation with the other stakeholders. The issue of the fact that your regional division have got regional jurisdiction. Now, because of the regional jurisdiction, you run the challenge of forum shopping or litigants may litigate everywhere within the province. So if we take that example, it means that somebody may, while the person stays in Cape Town, the defendant stays in one that may litigate in Stellenbosch, because the regional court of those jurisdictions. So we have discussed it more extensively, and we found that the matter could be regulated by the minister's authority given under Section 2 of the Market Act, which provides the minister with the power to basically consent to each and every area in the Republic. How we thought we'll do to remedy the situation is that the regional division will have civil jurisdiction in respect of civil disputes that have arisen within a ministerial district, which therefore means that if a dispute has arisen within Mitchell's Plain, the jurisdiction that the regional court will have will be conferred by the municipality of Mitchell's Plain, which means the regional court president will assign the case to Mitchell's Plain. It will be the magistrate who will come from Cape Town or ever to go and deal with the matter at Mitchell's Plain, because one, the course of action happened within Mitchell's Plain, or two, where the defendant is resident in terms of law. So those are the kind of aspects which will not basically hinder the debate in current form, but they can basically be cleaned up or refined in terms of notices. And we are sitting with the law advisors to make sure that those notices will basically be scrutinized legally. But we are saying those notices will be far better than the current one, which says if you're in King William's Town, we can only litigate in a forum in if you're in Bloemfontein, can only litigate in a forum in King William's Town. Those are the aspects that we have covered, Chairperson, and my colleagues are welcome to add
Thank you very much. You know, JB, you are so thorough and so passionate, and I'm just very suspicious. I thought this bill was relatively easy, but you have been so passionate about this thing. I am getting deeply suspicious about other members. Something's hidden here in this bill, and sure, distracting us from. Okay, I'm sorry, then I'll say speak of yourself. You want to say anything about the side that affects you that you raised last week? We got Advocate Susan on the side. Do you want to say something quickly before the members come in?
Well, I mean, today the most of the issues were issues that were sorted out and explained.
Right.
And that we hope that we can work through. And the time aspect, for example, and the rules and those kind of things, issues that we have discussed, and we'll see how we can possibly deal with that. I think we've agreed consensus all around.
Okay.
And everybody is in it, at least. We are all absolutely behind this.
Good. Now, you want to say something about that? Yes?
Okay, just with regards to one or two issues, the concerns that the parliamentary session has raised with regards to case backlogs. So there's something I'm very, actually, as Remo co-president of the Western Cape issue, which actually is a cause of concern to me in this division, and that is how much time we waste because of courts not running. And every month I keep a tab on that. And at one stage, I think in 2006, we lost about more than 1,000 court days where courts weren't running because of roads collapsing. We tried to remedy this by asking or telling magistrates not to increase the work, really, the load. But in the event of one or two cases collapsing, then you might have enough backups, which is not actually the right problem, but that's the only way we can do that. It's because it's sometimes very difficult to foresee somebody might get sick, then you have that.
Yes.
But, like in the regional court, you have rules book, So if a case collapses, then the rest of the day, there's no other matter to draw from other courses. Then you have a problem. And this is where the civil jurisdiction will assist greatly. If you talk about the summoning court days, you're talking about 3 years. You understand, in terms of that. So this is where civil jurisdiction will assist us, where we can say, listen, you have rights. That happened now, let's do something else. You've got other work to do. And that was one of the biggest challenges we had in the regional courts, because you were limited to one specific thing. In that regard, you can spread your capacity, and in that regard, you can assist in so far as that is concerned. With regard to the issue of forum shopping, that's currently people try that, especially in the criminal court presently. And we are very aware of that, because certain attorneys are going to change in front of certain courts for different reasons, and we are aware of that. And legal court presidents, and we pick it up where a regional magistrate will tell me, say, listen here, but this person, he should summons in, say, for instance, Worcester. But why is this case in Galvo? So the latter will be able to monitor and sufficiently, because I think a person will, when work comes to him that shouldn't be with him, he or she will pick that up. So that we can monitor effectively, so that we can tell people, listen, yes, go away, go back to the forum where you should be. So those are things we need to do, to look at. What I would actually, maybe speak to the department after that, and we are doing a good question, we need some flexibility in terms of also transferring cases to a centre where it's not so busy. Obviously, we're looking at agree to it. Because let's say, for instance, let's say that David used the example of Mitchell Slane. If Mitchell Slane has been clogged with cases, civil cases, because of the busy court law, and you have to look at Weinberg or Cape Town, where we don't have such a we need that flexibility to transfer those matters. We'll tell them that you can either wait 18 months or I can help you within 2 weeks. So that type of flexibility we need in terms of case flow management. That's what we need as a young court president also. So that's what happened in our backlog courts, where we started in the criminal courts, where we thought we saw at one court we have 500 cases because of certain issues. At another court we have less cases. We transfer matters to there. Obviously, people will be prejudiced, but we need to have the flexibility to manage that. But I think that's something we can sort up with the department. But like I'm saying, in terms of those, this bill is welcome, in terms of those concerns.
Basically, the issues you are raising relate to practical implementation and those challenges. They don't affect the clauses in the bill. Yeah, I think in the future for your mic off, somebody else is... Yeah, but mine has to be on to some people.
Let me try this one, just one better. Okay, Christine, you want to respond to the response to your question?
Before we start the clause by clause. Mama Slavik?
I think the implementation of this basis is facilitated. It's been long overdue.
Yeah.
When we speak of access to justice,
yeah,
we really mean that this year has to be implemented. But I have a question. I have two questions about the replacement of the LLB. If now the LLB is not used as a basic qualification, can I get clarity as to what is going to happen? Because you cannot just take people from this matrix, for instance, and put them and train them as much. And also the presiding officer of the divorce court. What are the qualifications for those people? Or what are going to be the qualifications for those people? And thirdly, if during the process of the processing of this year, can you get me the report that we show actually all the intended written and quote. And then with that, we have a detail of the infrastructure and the resources, in particular written and quote. I'm saying this because I know some of these districts, written and quote, for instance, have got a problem of infrastructure and quote. Can we get such a report in the project?
The requirement, early requirement in the Act was put at the time when the appointment mechanism was arbitrary. There was not a judicial service commission, there was no message commission. Any, the executive could appoint any other person. And that was one of the safety mechanisms to make sure that we meet the requirements. Currently, Ms. Mata, we sit together at the message commission. The commission would first get the qualification, will first shortlist. They get the applicants, they shortlist, and I think the shortlisting committee will first look at whether these people are properly qualified and are competent and assistant and professional. This is a mechanism. There is no way, I think, even if the entire JSC are going to be replaced tomorrow, there's no way we can anticipate that we have a JSC which can take somebody who has not even had and it's like as to what the law is, and not going through the university job, can suggest to the president that the person must be appointed as a judge. But now what happens? After the recommendation of the Ministerial Commission, it goes to the executive, where before the president or the minister appoints, they satisfy themselves in terms of the requirement. They look at the submission of the JSC, they look at the submission of the Ministerial Commission, and if the Ministerial Commission may have missed a point in terms of the fit and proper requirement, the president will send the matter back to the JSC with the reservation. They say, I realize here this person has not gone to school. We think they're competent judges, and I don't think that 23 members of parliament, academicians, practitioners, advocates, it will pass through their heads. That's why we say, to the extent that there are mechanisms in place to address it, it's no longer necessary. We don't say it's not a requirement. We say it's no longer necessary to prescribe whether one LLB, LLM, LLC, etc. There are mechanisms to make sure that it is covered in terms of abandonment process. So there won't be a catastrophe. We still have 10, etc. That's why even in the appointment of charges, there's a commission there. But the system, yes, with this kind, because we may have the best decrees, but there's still not the fit person to hold the offices. So it's not the only requirement. We say they were there in the law because of the past system. Current the mechanisms and the mechanisms have been built in to make sure that you get a competent person. So it doesn't cause problems. The work qualifications, we do not have a complete order of all of them. But the deputy minister appoints on 3 month basis, acting presiding officer for the divorce court system. And the deputy minister, any submission that goes to the deputy minister must make sure that that person has got necessary qualifications and the person has got knowledgeable, is knowledgeable about the law. And family more in particular. So there are still mechanisms in place to make sure that no person without the necessary qualifications will be entrusted with this difficult task of deciding people's rights or so in the court. And so we will basically provide
I think with regard to the request for a report, we will come back with the structure and dealing with that to show exactly what is envisaged with regard to capacity, things like that, just to give an indication what will be requirements in terms of the HR, all the other aspects, so that you have a proper picture of it. So we'll come back to you on that.
JB has had to go out, he did explain. But he has another matter to attend to, but he's going to come back as soon as he can. Okay, let's...
Thank you, Chair. When this bill is passed, and I'm sure it will be passed, we will have 3 tiers of court for the first time now. But I think it's still an interim measure. Now, how different will this be to the final measures which the party is working on? I hope. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, that one is, it would be speculative to try and answer that at this stage. Members will see, as we go through the bill clause by clause, we will go into some detail on some of the suggestions that were made by ARMS that they've raised. They pointed out certain areas where they think they should even be given more jurisdiction, matters that they did first be going to get some policy arrangements on. But as I said the last time, we are dealing with the 1944 Act, and we will be reinventing the wheel, so to speak, when it comes to the lower court. So it is very difficult at this stage to look into the crystal ball to see where exactly we'd be going. The only thing we can say for sure is, bearing in mind the values, if I can call it that, that the Constitutional Court highlighted when they dealt with the Van Rooyen matter, where they confirmed the constitutional framework of higher tier courts and lower tier courts, that we must accept we will have those kind of hierarchy in our courts. But we will probably be moving towards the direction of entry-level courts, then an intermediary-level court, which will probably, the Constitutional Court will evolve to that, and our current high court system would, again, probably be less likely to be courts of first instance, but more aimed towards dealing with reviews and appeals. But as I say, it's really speculative at this stage here, but the signs are there that we are moving in that direction. As I pointed out at the earlier occasion as well, that's one of the comforts when dealing with this particular bill, is that I do not think with respect we need to really find answers to all the questions at this stage when it comes to delining the areas of jurisdiction. This is really a first step. At the moment we have nothing, and we're giving a first step to in a certain direction.
Why are you so vague, given that Polikwan has given you precise directions on sorting all these things out?
No.
And he also wants to know from you, what about the street committees and the court at that level? When you talk of entry level, presumably you're starting at the street committee level. Right?
Which committee?
Okay, Dr. Delphine will speak to you later. He doesn't want to put you under pressure.
Also, Chair, I think just while we're at this, all members here will be aware of what the Superior Court's draft bill at this stage looks like. In fact, the committee sees where that bill at this point is done, and I'm not going to. Well, it's introduced and it's formally before this committee, being
we passed a resolution by way of this committee, which is probably going to copy up. That bill, Parliament decided by the end of this quarter, will review progress, but the bill is really in a very technical sense only. Otherwise, let's go ahead and just take that bill and have public hearings next week, love. Is that what you're suggesting, Mark?
Chair, no, I'm not addressing on that issue. But there is a framework, and we're working towards a framework, and it is really important, especially when it comes to the hierarchy in terms of which judicial authority, and I'm referring to judicial management more, not giving judgments, but judicial management, judicial governance, to make it very clear where you've got the Chief Justice right at the top and then through all the levels until even the Assistant Magistrate. We need to get those structures in place, and that will really be the starting point. And also, when we come to reinventing the wheel with regard to the lower court, once you've got that structure in place, the whole process of consultation and negotiation becomes much more easier, but it's important to get that in place.
Yeah.
Well, there are all sorts of suggestions, Chair.
We can see on board. Okay, let's carry on. There was a question of Chief Swartz.
Might be just replacing the tires, but some people are even suggesting we put redirection.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for this.
We'll keep them busy.
I won't come up with a constitutional argument. I like the simile, the metaphor of climbing Kilimanjaro. I think the question, and that is very valid, I think that we all support the sentiment behind this bill. obviously we've continually raised the issue of capacity and infrastructure and attempted to give an answer, JD, but I think what we would need to know is when we pass this bill, can we get the base camp? Not climb the whole mountain. Or can we catch a cableway up Table Mountain or something? Just that first part. And you have indicated that you've got the integrated implementation plan. But we would need to know from point one what additional resources are given immediately. It doesn't have to be to get us up to the top of Kilimanjaro. But because of the backlog problems existing, which we know will be alleviated, that is the concern, I think, of the public and the many people. That if we pass this bill, can it be, will there be additional resources from day one? Even if you plan to appoint 1,000 new staff, will we at least get 100 new staff? You remember with the maintenance court bill, the maintenance officers bill, it took quite a while before the maintenance officers, and everyone was waiting for that. So we create a wonderful expectation, but that is what we would like to see, the feedback when you give us on that implementation plan. As opposed to a step approach, climbing Kilimanjaro. What can we do base camp immediately? That's the first point. Secondly, just on the issue of the money and the monetary jurisdiction, I know it's still speculative and it will be decided on, but if we're talking about a figure of the district court up to 150,000 and then from the regional court 500 up, there's a gap. Clearly there can't be, or am I misunderstanding this? Because they've got to reach each other. Otherwise, you're going to have a gap between district court up to 150 or 200, and then regional court from there. They must be up to 200 and then from 200. Otherwise, the gap, the people have to go to the Supreme Court, and we'll miss that. So I might have misunderstood that, but we need to, they must meet one another, as opposed to there being a gap. And I'm sure the minister will have that discretion, but I just need your advice that I misunderstand that. And then the last quick point is, at one point, ANSA raised the point that they're not doing any equality court cases. Now, is that just because they're not placed on the regional court and they're at district court level? It might be useful if they already start doing those equality cases now. There's no problem with that jurisdiction. It might just be the paucity of cases in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. To follow the last one, I think the Honourable Member is right. Equality court is basically, in most instances, a private individual. That is what they say. It's somebody against a shop owner, etc. So, if you don't have two jurisdictions, you are limited by respect. So, this bill will make sure that they also do that immediately. That's why we say, as part of the policy analysis, we are looking at the immediate impact of the bill on the full range of legislation. So that they should also get this kind of jurisdiction across their board, etc. And we also have to deal with the structure of the equality court as well, to make sure that we close the gap. Yes, perhaps I may not have put it correctly and in a more clearer way. The intention is that the one day gets the monetary jurisdiction will be up to 156 court if the minister so decides. Then we then bring from 150 up to 500. The regular court then from 500 up to whatever amount, if somebody is able to initiate a claim of a CDA or so on. So that's the same thing around the bill. So, the integrated plan is an ongoing process. The teams have been making to do some adjustments also. And I think we should be able to fairly share with the committee what our initial steps are, starting the mountain planning. And we are looking at the way we've worked on it. We've worked on from the 1st of April in the new financial year. So there are basically positive infrastructure realignment in place currently. And we've kind of incremented the cost for them over the next 3 years or so. So we'll be able to share the program with Parliament in the short term. Thank you.
Carol, can you also pick up these issues we picked up yesterday?
Some of them actually came back to me and said they don't experience that.
The, what also came out of the discussion yesterday and what we wanted to assure the members, the bill does not change the substantive law as it stands. Aspects of mediation, reconciliation, and also the family advocate in terms of funding so continue. It does not change that. So to the extent that there are matters that require assistance from the family advocate in the sovereign divorce court, will be dealt in the very same way, but in the original court. Just to promote its access. And this is consistent also with the department's vision to increase the capacity of the family advocate, so that you also have a threshold that those indigent and poor people who are in any event need some kind of assistance. They should be assisted, not only in the Southern Divorce Court, elsewhere, even in the High Court. The second point is from the practitioners, and I think, and that's what you said yesterday, it's good that we can sit and talk from our side in terms of our pockets and our own positions, etc. But in the end of the day, we must be informed by what the people's needs are. Advocates will basically stand up and say, but taking risk from me. Because immediately the bill is passed. It means my attorney, not advocate, will get huge instructions to go to the regional court to deal with this matter. Advocates who are most expensive will have the matters diminished to deal with this matter in the High Court. But don't see it that way. We see it from the perspective that advocates and judges, they are overloaded. They are biting more than what they can chew because of the system. Attorneys are stunned. They have got nothing to buy. So if we were to come with an argument, that's why we get different views. Attorneys are very happy clapping hands. Because it means they've got more to buy than chew. Advocates, they've got more to buy, but they don't want to lose what they cannot buy. So they always come back and say. But we said we don't want to enter that debate. We want to look at a person who needs access to justice and needs to be assisted without even having to go that extent of comparing between artists and advocates. And I think those are experiences that will always play themselves up in practice. But I think we have taken a balanced view of the need for access from the people's perspective, but also of a need to make sure that we sustain the profession, because the profession feeds the judiciary. We must not come to a situation where we don't have advocates, because they have lost all their wealth.
Okay, very briefly, just the reason why the divorce courts are perceived, which might be even a real perception field, to be cheaper and more accessible is because of their rules. Now their rules, if you look at clause 7, we're retaining the rules as part of the constitutional provision until specific rules are designed for the regional court. But the idea is very definitely that all those aspects which make those courts special will be retained and even improved on as far as the regional courts are concerned. And the second assurance I can give is that during our discussions with AMSA, we arrived at that conclusion. We actually need stronger rules provision
in this law, and he will be working on making the proposal in that regard. But I think it's very important. We're not taking anything away. When it comes to divorce and education, we are really not taking anything away in terms of this bill. This bill is giving more. It's not taking anything away.
Just one question. Has there been any consultations with the judiciary, with the Chief Justice and the other members of the judiciary, and with the advocates and attorneys?
Chair, yes. We've not had a formal input, but the matter was raised with them as recently as last week again at the meeting with all the heads of court. It's not to say that we might, especially if we're looking at extending the jurisdiction to beyond what we've got in the bill at the moment, that we might even end up having a formal submission. But we're engaging with them, but we don't have a formal submission.
There we are. We're close by close, is that right? Okay. Let's move on it. Right, you have the bill before you. Take us, JB, through the bill. You're on page 5 of the text.
Okay, thank you very much.
Oh, there's
two documents that I need to bring to the committee's attention. First is the summary, and I believe the summary has now been handed out to members. Mine doesn't have a number yet.
Oh, okay.
It is LHJRCLH.
Sorry, is this in me?
Yeah, I'm just explaining this summary document. The summary of the comments. I just want to explain there that when I entered my office this morning and I opened my email, I saw for the first time that there's been a submission from the Commission on Gender Equality. And I started...
Sorry, Gerson is extremely disruptive, needless to say. Where are we? We are looking at... Yeah, my filing system needs to improve. God, where's that? So, can you see another copy? There's somebody here. Here it is. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Yah. What about it?
Chair, I just want to point out that I only learned today of the submission of the Commission on Gender Equality, and I entered them. They will see it as the last row in the first column. But
where is the submission from the Gender Commission? Oh, it's there. Yeah. We haven't seen it yet. Oh, we haven't gone through it. All right, okay, we'll, okay, fine.
But that's as far as I've got with summarizing their comments. So the document is read and incomplete. I still have to add them when it comes to the rest.
But why don't we do this?
Certainly, Chair, then the second document that I must draw your attention to, I see there is copies on the table. This is the Magistrates Court Act, as it is at present. Our suggestion is that each member should take this and study this, and then by the end of next week, maybe you can write a short exam on the...
Actually, you know, I was
really
got hold of the Gender Commission, but you know, I was really just careful. Why?
You know where you have this sort of situation, where you are amending old bills and so on. Parliament, the living playing field is not level. Parliament doesn't have the capacity to check that all these schedules and so on that you've got are properly cross-referenced and so on. And I'm raising this with the Speaker's office and with the chairperson of committee. That's absurd. You can't expect Christine to go through all of that. It's just not fair. So I want to discuss that separately. We are members of the committee. You've been interested in the seat for 6 years now. I've been trying to win this debate. No way can we pass a bill until a department gives us a implementation plan. And then we go and study to this, and we'll see that what they're putting on paper is feasible. You know, everybody agrees with me, but nobody does anything. But nobody does anything. I've raised this thing, I've written to the Speaker 3 times, I think, in the last 6-7 years, and so on. 2 things. One is the finances. That means this sort of stuff, you know, Johan, I mean, it's drivel, really. There's another thing there that says, consultation, I would like to see much more than you have there, right? And then you'll have a thing about financial implications, and really it's just a 1-line, 2-line thing. It's meaningless. We want a plan, a budget,
and a plan. I think you will agree with me. Then our bills will be more modest. You know, that what we try to do and will be more incremental and so on. But anyway, we shall win that battle before 2050. In the meanwhile, let's continue.
Thank you. In that instance, it's rather important to have a look at the principal act from time to time, so as to understand what you're really talking about when it comes to the amendment check. Also, just to add that, you can turn to the preamble then, Chair. I don't think I need to point out anything specifically here. Safe to remark that at yesterday's meeting, there was some resistance from the president, the existing president of the divorce court. They do not like the reference to the courts as they are having their origins based on race. I thought I'd just remark on that. But as far as preamble is concerned, there's nothing that I'd really like to point out to you. And then if you'd like to reflect on the concept of preamble.
Carol smiling and Imam writing letters to I don't know who, but clearly everybody is, as Carol would say, happy. I don't know if you can Carol. We're all happy.
You would not
happy. Remember the happy, says Carol. Who am I to question that? Okay, let's go on to page 3.
So with the sense she remembers, didn't change her mind by changing in fact where.
No, don't be prepared to
that. So the first clause is very simple. This is section 2 of the Principal Act that's being amended. Now this is the section in terms of which the magisterial districts are created, the courts, the regional divisions are created, they chopped and changed. The minister's got very wise powers in that regard. The first amendment there is to E, that is just the addition of or she, that is cosmetic. Then, well, it's technically correcting the issue, while you're on that, chair, it's interesting if you look at the Gender Commission's submission, they actually refer to he, the minister is he, do this, and I thought that was remarkable. The E at capital A, they say that's the first new thing. It's a repeat of the minister's power when it comes to the declaration of regional division. For all purposes, for such purposes as he or she may declare, annex any regional division or any portion thereof to another regional division. The minister can do that in respect of districts. Now we want the minister to do this in respect of regions as well. And the reason being that it will facilitate the incremental approach that you envisage in this regard, so that you can combine regions for the time being if necessary, so that you can use the existing resources without having to make sure that each and every regional magistrate can do everything in terms of jurisdiction. If it's really just consequential, is that you need to make the distinction then that your district courts are established for the purposes of the trial of persons accused of committing offences and adjudicating civil disputes contemplated in 29.1. Just to make it clear that the district courts have civil jurisdiction and criminal jurisdiction. The next amendment, establish a court for any regional division for the purposes of first the trial of persons committing offences and then the new part.
Do we want to raise questions as we go to each sub clause, or do we want to finish the whole of that section 2 and then come back to it? How do you want to do it? Well, let's do the whole thing and then we come back
here. Yeah. The only new part in hearing is the addition, adjudication civil disputes contemplated in section 291 and 291B, making it clear that the regional divisions will in the future also be adjudicating civil disputes. The rest of that clause is as the Act reads at the moment.
To help the members, we do have the areas which have been proclaimed as regional divisions of the given different regional courts, etc. So what we are going to do as part of this proposal schedule will be clarified the list to make sure that also covers the 7, etc.
Any other questions, Carol? Can I ask you a quick question? It's clear, isn't it? Maybe not to me, but it's fine. There's not anybody else can see it. When you're referring, for example, let's look at 2.1f, right? Roman numeral 1, line 2. You should have jurisdiction contemplated in sections 89 and 92. And then in Roman numeral 2, you got in section 29.1. Now, which sections is it referring to? The original act. And that's obvious to the average person reading it. So my mother will be able to understand when she reads that.
Yes, is she one of those members of the public who also frequently buy the government officials?
Yeah, I know, she does. Okay. All right, any questions then on subsection, I mean on section 2? No. This is basically dealing with the minister's powers. All we've done is to the original act, added the lines underlined, okay? Is that correct? Okay. Thank you. Let's move on to the next clause.
Clause 2, Chair. Clause 2 deals with the repeal of subsection 1c of section 9 of the Act. Now, you can only understand that if you look at the principal Act.
Yeah.
This section reads 9.1c, says the magistrate of the regional division may also be the magistrate of the district and shall, for the purposes of section 12.5, be deemed to have been duly appointed as an additional magistrate for each district, except the district of which he or she is the magistrate, falling wholly or partly within the regional division of which he or she is the magistrate. The reason for the repeal is simply it's not been applied, and it is definitely not now required any more because the regional court, beg your pardon, will have civil jurisdiction.
Any comments, questions here? Clarity issues? Nope? Okay, can we move on? Thank you.
Amendment to section 12 of the Principal Act. The first amendment there. Making it clear that the regional court may, subject to subsection 6, which is a new subsection 6, may only be held by a magistrate of the regional division. B, shall possess such powers and perform such duties conferred or imposed upon magistrate as he or she is not expressly prohibited from exercising or performing either by the minister or the magistrate of the district. And that is changed with by law. Actually, I should just pause with that provision for a while, Chair. That is the B that I've just referred to. It's not really got anything to do with the legislation. It is just giving effect to part of the judgment of the Constitutional Court in front of Wayne to say that this specific part was not constitutional. So it's just a key exercise.
Why was
it
not constitutional?
It could be interpreted by the reasonable person as allowing the minister to dictate terms to an independent.
Yeah, and that's the point. Yeah. Okay. Right. Any questions about that? No? Good. Thank you. Let's move on.
Then it's repealing subsection 5 of section 12, see, that specific subsection I need to refer to again. The principal act. Is that it relates to that earlier amendment? Subsection 5 at the moment says the magistrate of regional division may, in his capacity as additional magistrate for a district in terms of section 91C, hold the court of that district. Now, you'll recall we're repealing 91C, so this one is no purpose any longer, so this specific portion is already repealed. Then, section 7, they have a major position, Chair. It says only a magistrate of regional division who has completed an appropriate training course and whose name appears on the list of 13 sub 7 may adjudicate civil disputes contemplated in 29.1 and 29.1b, and 7 that the DG must compile and keep a list of regional magistrates who have completed the training course. This is may I just point out at this early stage that we need to reflect on this provision, that we will probably come and request the portfolio committee to consider an amendment here. The rationale for this provision is that you've had regional magistrates who've now for years just done operating, etc.
Yeah.
And now you're going to give them extended civil jurisdiction, and you just need to make sure that they're actually on par with the law as far as that is concerned. But the provision is actually too wide. Because as it is now, it means that no single regional court magistrate can have this jurisdiction
without first being the cause. Forgetting that, how do you fill posts of regional magistrates you advertise? Now, you may well get very, very well experienced civil magistrates from the district court who apply for this post. In that case, it's not necessary to have this qualification that the person must go to a training course. Or you may get applications from experienced attorneys, advocates, strong civil practices to apply for a post appointment. And so you do not want this qualification to be universally applied. And we will probably suggest that it be moved to the transitional position so that you make sure that it's really applicable to newly or existing regional court magistrates who want to exercise the jurisdiction, or you do need some flexibility. I'm not going to elaborate on that.
Carol. Okay. Carol? All right, let's have you reply and then the...
Yeah, it was actually one of it was discussed at length with ARMSA. They also had a problem with appropriately put the pros and the cons, but we decided that since we're going to really visit this in the end, we will have to look at that aspect as well. What makes it difficult, Chair, is that we're always guessing, second-guessing, when is justice... No, when is the judicial institute, that African judicial institute, education institute. Once that is up and running, these questions may begin to become festival fighting to a limit, but until then we need to focus more.
And do you want to reply? Oh, do you want to say something, Jerry? Yeah, go ahead.
Part of what we said was to refine is that this kind of state of apostate, you can start that put them a medical status because as a proper justice college or any appropriate. At the meantime, one for the institution, so that this is provide some sense of second.
Yeah. Are you happy with that, Carol? Yeah, okay. Shall we do that? Shall we agree, Christine, note that? That's what we committee once done, and in fact, JB himself offered to do it in the first place. Okay. Let's have the president of the room. Do you want to say anything? Sorry, do you want to say anything? Carol said you might want to say something.
Yes, I think.
Okay, right, let's move on.
J29 is mainly consequential, it is necessary. Because the civil jurisdiction provisions in the Principal Act at the moment only deals with district courts. So it is necessary to create a distinction to make very sure that we are now also referring to regional courts. I'm not going to read through the whole provision, I think it's fairly.
Where are we today? I'm a bit lost. You're doing clause 4 now?
Clause 4. The amendments to 28.
To 28, yeah, you said 29. Okay, yeah, 28, yeah.
You see, we're just adding for a district or a regional division. And that is all with a view to getting to the top of page 5 of the bill.
Right.
We're now inserting a new 1A, on capital A in section 25, 28 rather, which says for the purposes of 29.1B, a court of original division shall have jurisdiction if the parties are either parties be domiciled, ordinarily resident. So just to fix the jurisdiction in respect of certain parts of the region is concerned, and not the district is concerned.
Right. Maybe we anything else you want to say in response to this? Just one quick question. That's not less than 1 year. Why is that there in 1A Roman numeral 2? The last line there.
Sure.
Okay, not less than 1 year. You have to be ordinarily a resident in the Republic for a period not less than 1 year immediately prior to that date. Well, why is the time less?
I think it's a criterion being inserted to ensure that to prevent forum hopping most of you. I'm sure that all this will be copied from some other principle elsewhere.
Maybe?
No, we'll check it.
You'll come back. Okay, the next clause.
Section 129. This is also a very important clause. The first amendment there is just a correction referring to the National Credit Act. Then it adds, due to a jurisdiction respect of causes of action, that is really the matters that can be adjudicated by district courts and now regional courts. The first two amendments there are simply kind of technical, changing the, updating the Credit Agreement Act. But then this capital 1A from line 45 on page 5, that is the real important part, where firstly it says that the minister can now determine different amounts in respect of courts for districts and courts for regional divisions. That is the monetary jurisdiction criteria, so that you can determine higher criteria for the regional court. And then this capital 1BA. Now those provisions deal with the divorce matters and marriage and all those kind of issues. They really just a duplication of the jurisdiction provisions we presently find for the existing divorce courts. In the course of our discussion here and with hindsight, we've realized that there is also some room for improvement here, relating to the nullity of a marriage, relating to divorce, etc. It would probably be better or even more prudent if you take cognizance of the Civil Union Act that was recently passed by Parliament. I think we should, even though it makes no difference in terms of the law, it would be better, I think, to consider the reference to that as well. But otherwise, the provisions are really exactly the same as it is for the divorce court at the moment.
Yeah.
Does it mean that the regional court will now have inherent jurisdiction as far as marriage and that sort of thing is concerned?
So I don't think it's inherent, but they will have definite jurisdiction. This is the same position that the divorce court has. I don't know what to be theoretical, but these courts are cases of statute, so they do not have inherent jurisdiction, but the Constitution, of course.
What do you mean inherent jurisdiction?
That is what I was about to say, sir. I think it's rather a grey area in this day and age to how you define, your inherent jurisdiction. The only inherent jurisdiction that the Constitution recognizes, as far as I know, is of the High Courts, courts of those statutes to regulate the act process. I think it would be a nice area for thesis.
What does inherent jurisdiction mean?
It means, really, as I understand it, that there need not be an act saying that the court has the power to do this or that. The court has that power in any event, merely by the fact of being a court. That's how I understand it. But in this case, because this act was specifically giving the jurisdiction to the regional courts, that's why I don't think it can be regarded as inherent jurisdiction.
It has jurisdiction to say any matter, doesn't need an interim act to give it power to entertain it. That was in the case of the High Court.
Section 46 of the Principal Act, one needs to look at the Principal Act. Subsection 1 being appealed there. And subsection 1 at the moment says that subject to the provisions of the Indian Immigration Law number 25, 1891 of Natal, the court shall have no jurisdiction in matters in which the dissolution of a marriage or separation from bed and board or for good or married persons is called. I don't think much argument that we're not even too sure whether that's
immigration law of 1891 still exists, but clearly it has no place any longer. And this issue is now comprehensively dealt with in the Act itself as far as marriage laws are concerned. The next would be the transitional provisions, Chair. They are also very important. And I think it will be best if I just go through them. First, it says any proceeding instituted in the court established under Section 10 of the Administration Amendment Act, those are the divorce courts, before the commencement of the section, not the act, the section, and which are not concluded before the commencement of the section must be continued and concluded in all respects as if this act had not been passed. This will not be a problem because those courts will still be existing in any event. There will be a name change, but the presiding officers will be there, everything will be there. Very easy to just carry on as if nothing has changed. Secondly, on the date of the commencement of the section, every one of those divorce courts becomes a court of the regional division designated by the minister in respect of that court. You must remember we've got three of those courts at the moment. The areas of jurisdiction cover most of the country. So the minister would need to sit down and say, okay, I need to make you part of a specific regional division for the time being. Like also for the time being. So that is just a technicality that needs to be addressed by the minister. See, any person who is an officer referred to in paragraph A of a court referred to in A, that is an officer of the divorce court, continues to hold such office as an officer. Sorry, should I skip B? B, any person holding office as a presiding officer of such a divorce court shall subject to any condition regarding his or her term of office and any condition of service applicable to his or her appointment to that office hold office as a magistrate of the regional division contemplated in paragraph A. All that is saying is if you have the permanent appointment as a presiding officer in a divorce court, then you will automatically become a regional magistrate of the division to which that divorce court is assigned. The caveats here or the conditions relate to if that person is at that time an acting presiding officer in the divorce court, he will still be an acting and will continue to receive whatever salary and conditions of service are applicable. But he will not, by reason of this act, all of a sudden become a permanent regional magistrate if you're not entitled to holding that position in the first place. Then C, any person who is an officer of the divorce court continues to hold such office as an officer of the regional court in question. And in this regard, I should just raise them. I'm jumping the gun a bit, but from our discussions with emergency, also our attention was drawn again to the fact that the divorce courts at the moment have registrars. But the Magistrates Court Act speaks of class of the court. So one of the cleaning up things we need to do is just make sure that we've got a provision in the Act that you can have registrars for the regional courts as well. It's something small to sort out, but it needs to be sorted out. Then subsidies. It's actually one of those, you see the administrative powers of the minister and even court management in terms of the Magistrates Court Act is very, very wide. This is really a name change issue, so you always work from the premises that all the officers in that court can simply be some officers of the regional court because they're doing the same thing. But you tend, well, in this case, you forgot the small technicality, like in the one court, the one is called the registrar, the other one is called the clerk of the court. Well, we discovered it in our, when going through our discussions, we just put it up as an idea. We just need to get that terminology right. If we, for example, do not do it here, it would not even be a problem. It would be needed just to make sure. Very, very likely, Chair. I wanted to draw your attention to the fact that you earlier made the statement you thought that this is going to be simple legislation. I think sensitize it to the fact that it is not, it's very complex.
That's not really true.
Take the credit as well if it goes well.
Just on that point, at present your regional courts don't have clerks because they don't have civil words. So is that a new post, or will the magistrate court clerk now have two hats, one as a registrar and one as a clerk?
We will be addressing that as well, Chief. The Act makes provision for the minister can appoint clerks for courts. Fortunately, the Act doesn't. The Act says courts can be a regional division, district division, but you will need to appoint clerks for regional courts, but you can use the existing provisions to do that. But it would be better, while we've got to look at the issue of registrar, to create a small sector provision, just to create that distinction. So, the clerks of the district court will, for all purposes, be the city clerks also of the magistrate court when it comes to civil work specifically. No need to create an artificial second post. It's more an issue of a job evaluation element. So you need more persons of action.
Yes, it also came up here from our discussion that so that you don't create a kind of fragmentation in hierarchy where you will find that clerks of the court may basically not be willing to deal with any civil matter because they're not defined as so. So the Act should basically provide that any clerk of court will be deemed to be an assistant of the regional court. So that we avoid a divide. And we'll also fill up the one deciding officers because we know that out of the current establishment, there are those who have not gone through the process of being absorbed through the market commission arrangement, exchange, whatever. So we just make sure that people don't come tomorrow and say, in terms of this exam, now I'm a magistrate, without having gone through the process, etc. So we'll deal those things to make sure that they are in sync with what we need.
If you return to the rest of the transitional provision then, sub 3, it just says that notwithstanding all the aforesaid provisions, firstly, the area of jurisdiction of any divorce court remain as it existed immediately before the commencement of the section. So that is subject to any subsequent amendment thereof, but for the time being, it will remain exactly as it is. And secondly, insofar as such area of jurisdiction overlaps with the areas of jurisdiction of other regional divisions, then those other regional divisions or the relevant portions of them will be deemed to have been annexed to the regional division of the court in question. And now you can see it refers back to section 218 of the Principal Act. That's why we needed right in the beginning of that little provision that says you can for particular purposes annexed. Then in 4, we've earlier referred to very briefly, the rules in force on the date of the commencement of the Act in respect of the divorce courts remain in force until they are appealed or amended by a competent authority.
Just as far as the rules, we've dealt with the divorce courts. Now, the issue that came up previously about the rules that will apply in other matters, civil matters. Would that be Supreme Court or would that just, and because I'm just thinking of the practical implication, you will have people that will have instituted a challenge in the High Court that will now want to maybe remove the case to a regional court because of its jurisdiction. What rules will apply? What constitutional provision, or is it just a process that we need? And then of course appeal, you could have it in thought of, and I think it was raised by JB, the issue of appeals from a district court, could they appeal to a regional court, and then to a high court, and then to the Supreme Court, and then to the constitutional court? Is there an additional appeal and review process? These are implications that one will probably deal with in the rules of procedure as presented in the magistrate court rules and the Supreme Court rules. But do we need constitutional provisions for those purposes? You've dealt only with the divorce court in the district.
Let me start with the easiest one first, which is also the last one, the issue of appeal. I don't think we envisaging any change to the appeal regime in terms of the Principal Act appeal from the Magistrates Court lies to the division of the High Court, which has jurisdiction. It is one of the issues that's being mentioned at the moment with regard to the longer term vision, whether you should have, if your regional court becomes a more intermediate court, if you should have an appeal mechanism from a district court to regional court at this stage, and certainly not in terms of this bill, it's not being introduced. Secondly, the rules, as the bill is at the moment, it will be magistrate's court rules that will apply. You needed these other rules of the divorce court to make sure that you can actually deal with divorce matters. Now, AMSA members will recall in their representation, they did make the case for high court rules being applicable. And subsequent to our meeting, the conclusion we've reached is that we would need some rules specifically to be applicable for the regional court, and we will be looking at the mechanism to ensure that that is the case. But we do not think it's feasible to make high court rules applicable to a court that is not a high court. Not at this stage. We can be probably looking at a transitional provision, which would say that it would be the magistrate's court rules. Now, it's depending very much on what kind of jurisdiction. If you extend jurisdiction to the regional court beyond what we've got in the bill as it is at the moment, where they can then exercise jurisdiction in matters which can be adjudicated in the high court but not in the district court, then obviously the district court rules will not make provision for the procedure or it's the likelihood. And our provision would then need to find a catch-all there so that if there's a gap, then you can apply other rules. But it will probably be more prudent to ensure that there will be purposely designed rules to govern the regional court in all respects when it comes to these civil matters. But it's definitely one of the issues we will be reverting back to the committee on.
And I think one of the area of consensus we reached is around said that you may find that part of the mechanism is carried to provide a kind of a strong provision that will basically compel the rules board to revisit their rules within a specific period. So we say the rules of the medical court apply, but the rules board to harmonize their rules within a period of 18 months after coming into operation of the decision. So that's what we are looking at in terms of the frame, not the provision.
If you repeal and savings, that's clause 8, it's really repealing the existing divorce courts. And clause 9 is rather important, it's the short title and commencement system. And it's just making very clear that you can determine different dates for the commencement of different parts of the legislation. Also, maybe six in respect of different regional divisions of for the purpose of 21G2, which is the principal act as intended by the Act. In other words, it's facilitating a comprehensive legal structure.
Can I just ask, is there a
lawyer
from the
funding
to
go
next?
I'm sorry if I will be taking you people back. You said that to be in the regional court, an LMC is required. Did I understand you correctly? Does it exclude people who have long experience either as attorneys or as magistrates? They will not be appointed as a regional court magistrate if they do not have an LMC.
No, we said we agree with the sentiment that the requirement is no longer necessary in the legislation. But for it will be part of the cleanup
of the entire legislation. We want it's not it won't be done immediately with this bill. So it will be removed so that it brings in harmony with the entire system. So there will be immediate impact in the sense that immediately it won't happen. But over long term system over this legislation, there will be a similar system of application of entrance to the judiciary. Yeah.
Another last question. I will pick up while reading the submission from Aramsa saying that maybe the rules that should be applicable are the Supreme Court rules and not the National Court rules. What is the likelihood of that happening? The regional court applying the Supreme Court rules instead of the National Court rules?
No, we did persuade them that you cannot operate in one court with a supranational court. So what we'll do in the provision, find a mechanism just to make sure that the whole process of harmonizing the rules to develop a proper mechanism for the rules is being faster. So the rules board will basically be requested through the legislative mandatory legislative provision to revise rules to develop appropriate rules. Because it may frustrate access. You may give access to the regional court, but if the rules are good to the High Court, it means that the High Court is the regional court is not the High Court. So all this move also comes into play.
The price, and because they get increased in salary, if they forego the demand, that's not really the answer. He doesn't know. I still think we should try to finish this bill in two sittings. Next Friday, and then the latest three sittings. And one last thing, Cecil Burgess, is that how you say it? He's a lawyer. He's got very strong views. You hear it. He's got very strong views on this matter, which Carol picked up in one sentence. Now, to facilitate things in fairness to him, what we do is before next Friday, maybe half an hour before the meeting, Cecil, yourself as the chair, and your team, just meet, and Lolly is available and Christine, you know, just meet half an hour before, let him get it off his chest, rather than opening the whole thing up again here in a committee meeting. But he was asked by our committee, he's doing a little paper, which paper, some study group, we can give it to the office in part of the week. We'll also send to you before next Friday. In that way, we facilitate faster. Finally, a thing that entered my head is Bulalani life, actually. If you might, I'll talk to whatever management is breaking up into like subcommittees and processing bills faster so that the decisions are made at committee level. But we use the time in the afternoon instead of, let me see.
Yeah, but this could be in the research and the same.